a whole archive of Jack's papers finally became available to researchers, and it presents a very eye-opening account of Jack's inner life, something that he often kept hidden from other people. So I'm trying to, in a way, demythologize Jack and to think about, present him as a real person, both as the real person I knew and as the person he thought of as himself. So I will begin reading. One of the things that I'm interested in the novel was in this book is a tremendous impact of his French-Canadian background, which, you know, has always been mentioned, but actually its influence was huge. So the part of the biography that I'm reading has to do with that. There's a dead child buried in the pages of Jack Kerouac's first novel, The Town and the City. A boy named Julian, still alive presence for his mother, who insists he's still taking care of us, even though we don't see him. He's still here. But the omniscient narrator swiftly moves on. It's Julian's brothers and sisters, characters who will burn savagely across days and nights of living, who will be the subject after all in the hundreds of pages that follow. And Julian is not here for them. Caught up in the tumult of their stories, the reader can easily forget the dead boy. He's survived by a twin named Francis, an odd duck intellectual who stands aloof from those around him. But nothing more is explicitly made of Julian himself. It's as if the writer had tested a hot ember, pulling away before it scorched him. The novel, published in 1949, is about the Martins, a large Catholic New England family, half Irish, half French Canadian. There are 8 Martin children, 5 boys and 3 girls, packed into a warm, lower middle class household bursting with life until the impact of the war scatters them. I read The Town and the City when I was 21 in the fall of 1956, hardly able to tear myself away until I'd finished it. I remember feeling that Jack Kerouac knew everything about the anguished but necessary process of leaving home. When I met Jack only a few months later, I was surprised to learn that he'd grown up with only one sister. In fact, compared to most French Canadians, Jack's parents had had an unusually small family. It turned out, though, that he actually did have a dead brother in his past named Gerard. Gerard had suffered from rheumatic fever. His heart had given out when he was 9, and Jack was 4. That was about all Jack ever told me about his brother, although he intimated that in some way this family tragedy explained him. He was 34 and deeply weary. A cloud of melancholy, ennui was his word for it, hung over his exuberance. In the midst of Manhattan, he talked longingly of the mountaintop in Washington, where the previous summer he had spent 63 days in unbroken solitude. "I'm just an old hermit," he'd tell me, warning me not to count on him. "Do what you want." The publication of On the Road, which he had written 7 years before in the spring of 1951, was less than 1 year away. He'd get wearier still once he lost his anonymity. I romanticized Jack at first, with his black hair, blue eyes, and ruddy complexion. I could hardly help it. He looked like a man who had walked straight out of the American wilderness. I thought I'd never met anyone who'd lived with more absolute freedom. No job, no money, no address. A need to simply keep moving, as if whenever he stayed anywhere too long, he exhausted the present by soaking it in too intensely. Jack could imagine each of his future destinations as if he'd already been there. Today, many would call Jack's way of life homelessness, but behind its seeming aimlessness was a fierce, often self-punishing discipline. He let me know that everything he did was in the service of his writing, and even urged me to follow his example and expose myself to a broad range of risk and experience so that I could someday write a big novel myself. Shortly before Jack's path crossed mine, he had gone down to Orlando, Florida, to see his mother, whom he called Ma Mère. It had been a Christmas visit. Nothing that suggested to me how fatally and inextricably he was bound to her, in a mutual dependence that had its convoluted roots in his earliest memories. Like Jack's other friends, I knew him and didn't know him. He could be open in a charismatic way that drew out other people's secrets, but he held on to his own. In the letters Jack wrote to certain people, he revealed his obsession with Gerard, but he never revealed it to me during the periods we lived together. Still, the clues were there, if only I'd recognized them. In a curious way, I think he felt at home with me. I'd found me a haven, he'd later write in Desolation Angels. I wasn't his type, really, not a girl with whom he was in danger of getting into deep water. He let me know right away that he usually went for dark women, women who looked fellaheen, as if they had Indian blood like his mother. Perhaps for that reason he felt safe enough to keep our relationship going over the next 2 years. He liked it that I was a writer and quiet the way he was, and he appreciated my efforts to make food for him that reminded him of his mother's cooking. I made him many pots of Lipton's pea soup, to which, at his suggestion, I added the Franco-American touch of bacon or salt pork. In those days, I had a big gray cat. Jack soon took it over, giving it the name Tigree. For some reason he didn't go into, he was very devoted to cats. He would feed Tigree in a way that never failed to charm me. Like a small boy, he'd lie flat on his belly, with his chin pressed against the brim of the cat's bowl, murmuring encouraging words, half in French, half in English. Many years later, I was startled when the eerie significance of those little scenes dawned on me for the first time as I read Visions of Gerard. When the little kitty is given his milk, I imitate Gerard and get down on my stomach. You happy, Tipu? Your nice Lala? I realized then that without knowing it, I had witnessed a secret sacrament, heard Jack Kerouac calling up his dead brother. One thing I noticed immediately about Jack was his astonishing ability to remember just the kinds of things most people would have forgotten. I've never known anyone whose past seemed so available to them. With an extraordinary rush of detail, Jack could recall a conversation with a stranger in a barroom, a high school football game in Lowell, Massachusetts, a diner where he'd stopped for coffee, in one of the godforsaken towns he'd passed through out west. I can still remember his way of digging someone he just met, the hunch of his shoulders when he'd lean forward, as if every word he was hearing was valuable, something to be saved up in the vast, roomy warehouse of his memory. He told me that the kids he'd grown up with in Lowell had called him Memory Babe. As a writer, Jack was uniquely equipped to work directly from life, yet all through his apprenticeship years in his 20s, he had resisted doing so. The year 1950 found him struggling with increasing frustration to follow up the town and the city with a second big canvas novel with fictionalized characters and events, written in a style heavily influenced by Thomas Wolfe and Herman Melville. But on December 28th, in a remarkable piece of confessional writing addressed to his friend Neil Cassidy, a first-person voice was born that would become the basis of the way he would write in the future. 6 months before he sat down to write On the Road, Jack knew he had achieved a breakthrough. Immediately vowing to renounce fiction and fear, he felt so intoxicated by the power and fluency his memory gave him that he could not resist the initial claim that he remembered the very day he was born, coming into the world on March 12, 1922, on a late afternoon, red as fire, when the winter snow of New England was dripping off the trees. But the crucial bottled-up material that had perhaps prompted his breakthrough pressed upon him. Quickly he got down to what he called the agonized cock of the matter. My brother was a saint, and that explains all. And his opening bravado faded. In fact, in a letter written a week later, he apologized to Neil for having briefly given in to the temptation to depart from the absolute truth. Jack's stern renunciation of fiction had been inspired in part by his admiration for Neil's artlessly open, freely associative manner of writing, in which nothing was held back out of shame, and he was intent on matching Neil's truth-telling. Having set himself the task of writing the friend he regarded as a surrogate brother, a true and not a false or subtle confession, Jack had to acknowledge at the outset that much of what he was about to write about Gerard would have to be drawn from what he'd been told by others, particularly his mother. He allowed that the mayor had probably exaggerated at times. But I have verification, Jack insisted, plus a pain in my heart sufficient unto these pages. As if he were still a child, he was not about to refute anything his mother told him. You know my mother, he wrote Neil. You know she was capable of hiding in the hall and peeking around the door jamb to hear every word uttered by my little saint brother. but Jack's voice was infused with the urgency of a man struggling to disentangle his adult sense of what was real and what was not from the image of this saint brother he could barely recall. "I knew him slightly," he told Neil. "At least I remember practically nothing." There are very few places in Kerouac's writing where he ever feels at a loss. It is only when he comes to Gerard that his memory fails him. From his mother's grief, a hagiography had been born, and Gabriel Kerouac had evidently been a very compelling narrator. The touchingly detailed anecdote she told her impressionable surviving son evoked a Gerard whose goodness and tenderness had been otherworldly, a boy who had fed whole droves and choral societies of birds from his holy windowsill, and who had wept over the death of a mouse he had rescued from a trap, and sternly lectured the family cat. "Bad one, why have you done this to a harmless little mouse that couldn't hurt you if it tried?" Gabrielle recalled Gerard drawing angels. Lying in the grass in the backyard, he had told her he was watching heaven, a place so real to him he was able to describe it to her and to the nuns in his parochial school, as if he had been granted a vision. Gerard's special relationship with his little four-year-old brother, Tijon, had also been a dominant feature of her stories. Mamère's two boys had been inseparable, and Gerard had taught Tijon everything he knew, from how to draw to how to be good. Lovingly admiring Tijon's rosy cheeks and the small body that was so much sturdier than his own, Gerard had called him Tipus, or Little Thumb. "I imitated him all my life," Jack told Neil reverently in one of the abrupt shifts of feeling that animated his new voice. He noted the fact that in photographs he and Gerard had looked very much alike when they were small, and regretted that he could not remember his brother's eyes or one thing he said. In fact, the only Gerard Jack's memory could summon up was quite different from the one he told Neil he'd always imitated. Like any real 9-year-old, Gerard Kerouac had not always been the gentlest of brothers. Undoubtedly, he had been a sensitive, gifted, and empathetic child, with an imagination very much heightened by the teachings of the Catholic Church. But confined to the house during the last months of his life, deprived of playmates his own age, and often in agony from his swollen limbs, he had sometimes run out of patience with Jack and treated him with a severity that was very frightening to a 4-year-old. "Just before he died, he slapped me in the face," Jack recalled. The slap had been his punishment for knocking over an elaborate crane Gerard had been carefully building with his erector set. What particularly disturbed Jack, even as a man of 28, was a hazy memory like a waking dream of a gaunt and ragged phantom standing over his crib in the middle of the night, staring at me with hate. Preoccupied with this incident all over again in a second letter to Neil on January 3rd, Jack asked, "After all I knew of his great goodness, what then was this vigil in the dark?" As he wrote, a memory came to him of watching his brother, almost grave and done for, sledding with the other children one winter afternoon, and having a premonition then that Gerard was going to die. "I feel that to him I was the knower of his death. It has been ever since that I feel like the knower of every man's death, every man I knew that has died." Although Jack had forgotten so much about Gerard, all the emotions of his childhood, sorrow, guilt, anger, a sense of abandonment, churned inside him as he worked on the first 3 installments of The Confession. The truth was, he had resented the frail boy, weakening day by day, who had become the focus of all his mother's attention. He could recall yelling for her when she was just across the room, oblivious to him as she nursed Gerard. "I wanted her to come to me, too." During one crisis in Gerard's illness, he had sat forlornly on the porch steps, locked out of his home. His father, a big man of misery, hidden in the house, groaning with pain from rheumatism in an upstairs bedroom, and worrying about being unable to work for several months, had also been unavailable to Jack during this difficult and chaotic time. As young as he was, he'd had an acute awareness of what he called a conspiracy between my mother and brother against my father and me, with an innocent little sister left out. This configuration would shift after Gerard's death when Jack would take his brother's place and win back the attention of his mother. "But my triumph was my loss," Jack wrote Neil. The bitter clarity of this insight, however, did nothing to free him from the grip of his childish logic. If according to Mamère, Gerard was Jesus, I was his flesh and blood Judas. That deadly equation made Jack the betrayer of his brother. He was an angel, I was a mortal. What he could have brought into the world, I destroyed by my mere presence. Death haunted childhoods ran in Jack's family. By the time Jack's father, Leo, was six, he had lost 5 of his 15 siblings. In 1892, a 6-year-old sister succumbed to tubercular meningitis. Over the next 3 years, 3 babies died of cholera, one after the other. The last fatality in 1896 was a 14-year-old girl. The death had unhinged Leo's hard-working father, Jean-Baptiste. In Canada, Jean-Baptiste had been an itinerant farm manager. He had moved his growing family 9 times. Sometimes they had lived in the area around Jean-Baptiste's birthplace, Rivière-du-Loup, on the northern edge of Quebec, sometimes further south, on the outskirts of Montreal. But in Nashua, New Hampshire, Jean-Baptiste had been quickly able to establish himself as a carpenter and build a 2-story frame house for his wife and children. There, 3 more babies were born. One more proof that the nomadic days of the Kerouacs were finally over was Jean-Baptiste's purchase of 2 adjoining family plots in the Nashua Cemetery. But as the plots filled with the coffins of his children, Jean-Baptiste set about destroying himself with drink. In the midst of thunderstorms, he would terrify his family by standing outside the house he had built, shaking a kerosene lantern at lightning bolts, and daring God to strike him down. He dropped dead in the midst of a violent argument with a relative when Leo was 15. Within a year, his exhausted wife, Clementine, followed him into the graveyard. Gabrielle Kerouac had a low opinion of her husband's people, comparing them to a pack of wild dogs, Leo being the notable exception. There was malice in her and a tendency that increased with time to view people outside her immediate family with contempt and suspicion. She herself had grown up motherless. So young when her mother died, she had no memories of her at all. Different aunts had had a hand in raising her. She would brag about their genteel ways, then bitterly complain that they had treated her like a housemaid. For a few years, Gabrielle had a stepmother she liked who gave birth to her half-brother and half-sister. But when Louis Levesque died suddenly at the age of 38 and the stepmother moved to New York, Gabrielle found herself alone in the world. She was only 16. Her father had come to Nashua as a laborer. He died the owner of a tavern, but left his daughter so penniless she had to go to work in a shoe factory, standing over a moving blade all day, skiving leather. Her fingertips turned permanently brown from the acid used for tanning. Gabrielle lived in a boarding house with other workers until she was 19. Then Leo Kerouac rescued her from the lonely existence of a factory girl. He took her away from Nashua, the scene of all their grim memories, and gave her a home of their own in Centralville, the most up-and-coming French-Canadian neighborhood in Lowell. She took fanatical care of the small, spotless world that was now hers, as if evil could be warded off with a dishcloth. It was a marriage of 2 orphans, determined to start a new, unshadowed life. But the young couple would have only a year before Gabrielle gave birth to a baby with a weak heart. Gerard's death was one too many for Leo and Gabrielle. It did not strengthen the bond between them. Instead, they retreated from each other. Leo would go more and more his own way, burying his grief by immersing himself in the small printing business he had recently established. In his spare time, he would obsessively follow the horse races and escape into the masculine world of gambling and hard drinking. When Leo came home at night after a poker game, he would find that his 2 small children, Tijan and Nin, had taken his place in bed. Gerard's painful death caused Leo to lose his faith and stop going to church, but Gabrielle became increasingly devout. Gabrielle came apart when Gerard died. "My mother was beside herself," Jack told Neil, "in the midst of her awful crack-up that cost her all her teeth. During the long weeks when she nursed Gerard day and night, she must have known how futile her efforts would be, though she prayed for a miracle. It was Gerard's 2nd bout of rheumatic fever, and his heart could not withstand it. There was no medicine that could cure him, but God did not intervene. Crazed with grief on the day of Gerard's wake, Gabrielle secluded herself from the relatives and neighbors who streamed into the house. The unbearable thought that her good little boy had never had a chance consumed her. Her own faith was threatened. The only way she could accept Gerard's death was to convince herself that he had been taken from her, from a reason known only to God. In his groundbreaking breaking study, Jack Kerouac, An Essay Poulet, the French-Canadian novelist Victor Levi Beaulieu suggests that the example of Sainte-Thérèse de Lisieux, the little flower, may have given Jack's mother a way to find solace in the belief that her son, too, had been a victim soul. In 1925, just the year before Girard's death, the canonization of Thérèse had been an event of great significance for French-speaking Catholics around the world, and French Canadians in particular. Throughout his life, Jack prayed to Sainte Thérèse. In fact, his devotion to her was silently woven into the fabric of the town and the city, for Thérèse's family name was Martin, and she'd been one of nine children. At first, Girard's death had seemed a thrilling event to four-year-old Jack because of its novelty. He ran up to his father on the street with the news, "Girard est mort," one more thing he would feel guilty about for the rest of his life. The small boy was certain that now things would change. Rumors of exciting preparations were in the air. We would all go away to Canada with Girard. His excitement lasted through Girard's wake and funeral. In 1950, he could still remember the nuns entering his house like a wave of dark light, the incense smell in the church, the black cars waiting outside, and how he had wondered on the way to the cemetery in Nashua why everyone was crying, since Girard was surely coming back. It was only when I saw his body lowered into the earth that my face fell. In the weeks after the funeral, he continued to wait for his brother's return. Meanwhile, his mother remained inconsolable. Every room and corner in their house reminded her of her loss. Leo quickly realized they could no longer live there. Within a month, he prepared to move Gabrielle and his children to a larger house on Hildred Street in a different part of Centralville. It was then that Jack first began to understand that Girard wouldn't be coming back, that he wasn't in Canada, and his brother's death had a terrifying finality despite all the talk of heaven. He was far too young for this lesson, but it couldn't be unlearned. For the rest of his life, he would wrestle with a pervasive awareness of mortality that made human effort and even love seem meaningless and futile. "I'm writing this book because we're all going to die," he would write, and on the road. In the Kerouac's new home, there was a small statue of Sainte Thérèse that his mother kept on a shelf. Jack could remember becoming afraid of it around this time, suggesting that something had made him associate the gentle little flower with Girard. Very soon after his brother's death, his mother had told him that Girard was now his very own intercessor, who had died to save me, as it were, from my mother's arms. He was later told that around the time they moved to Hildred Street, he had become a thin, sallow, weary child, very different from the robust tipus he'd been. Jack told Neil that the repercussions of Girard's death had turned him into a subtle and dishonest person, a kind of orphan within his own family. But he was as incapable of passing judgment on his mother as he was of letting go of the intercessor she had created for him. Perhaps one of the saddest and most revealing lines Jack ever wrote was this: "I bow to the mystery of my loneliness for Girard that I have never been able to remember." To renounce fiction and fear, the vow Jack made to Neil and himself in the winter of 1950 meant in part that he intended to write about his life from now on without resorting to fictional disguises. In the town and the city, his aim had been to write a universal American story, and he had deliberately avoided emphasizing the Martin family's ethnic background and their devout Catholicism. "Isn't it true," he wrote to Yvonne Lemaitre, who had written a review of his novel in which he'd raised questions about these issues, "that French Canadians everywhere tend to hide their real sources?" They were able to do that, Jack thought, because unlike other minorities, such as Jews or Italians, they could pass as Anglo-Saxon. A fiction writer today in our multiculturally minded era would make the most of his hyphenated background and, in fact, would consider it an asset. But 60 years ago, the label Franco-American would have been a liability for an ambitious novelist. Most educated middle-class readers had a low opinion of Franco-Americans and little interest in learning more about them. Sociologists referred to them as the silent minority. For many years, the millions of readers of Grace Metalius's 1956 bestseller, Peyton Place, where only one minor character speaks French, had no idea that the author came from a French-Canadian family, since her married name was Greek. The fiction Jack wrote right after The Town and the City was a series of abortive attempts at road novels in which the protagonist, loosely based upon himself, was generally called Ray Smith or Smitty. But the issue of obscuring his ethnic identity had tormented him. In a journal entry he wrote on May 19, 1950, guilt Jack had not previously acknowledged fully rose to the surface. He had smoked a good deal of marijuana, and in that free-floating associative state of mind, had a vision which he recorded in his notebook, a visitation from a French-Canadian older brother who scolded him for trying to de-French himself. He hinted I should go to Lowell or Canada or France and become a Frenchman again and write in French and shut up. He keeps telling me to shut up. When I can't sleep because my mind is ringing with gongs of English thought and sentences, he says, pense en français, knowing I will calm down and go to sleep in simplicity. Jack did not see this older brother as Gerard, but as my original self, returning after all the years since I was a child, trying to become an Anglais in Lowell from shame of being a Canuck. He wrote that it was actually the first time he understood that he had undergone the same feelings any Jew, Greek, Negro, or Italian feels in America. So cleverly had I concealed them, even from myself, so cleverly and with such talented, sullen aplomb for a kid. 2 months later, he made another attempt to write the road novel that was giving him so much trouble, this one about a 15-year-old French-Canadian kid from New Hampshire named Wilfred Freddy Boncoeur, who hitchhikes throughout America in search of his lost father, but did not get very far with it. When he did finally write On the Road as a true-life novel in the famous scroll draft composed in 3 weeks in the spring of 1951, he was ready to give his protagonist narrator his own name, which for Franco-American readers, at least, would have immediately established the ethnicity of that character. By the time the novel was published, however, in 1959, Jack Kerouac had become the symbolically named Salvatore Paradise. Due to intense pressure from the legal department of his publishers, Jack had been forced to disguise not only the names and identities of all the other characters, but his own, going so far as to turn his own mother into an aunt. But he did not stoop to putting in the details that would authenticate Sal Paradise's Italian background. There is not even a reference to pasta in the novel. On the Road has come to be the book most closely identified with Kerouac. The very name Kerouac has entered the vernacular, become a word signifying youthful restlessness and rebellion. The novel is now accepted as an American classic, as iconically American as Huckleberry Finn, a work it has often been compared to. It is celebrated for its sweeping portrayal of the American melting pot, and Jack is credited for being ahead of his time in writing about black people and Mexican migrant workers, groups left out of the fiction of other white American writers. Jack himself is generally perceived as all-American, as one of his many biographers, Barry Miles, put it, carelessly painting the picture of the all-American boyhood Jack was supposed to have had, consisting of hamburgers, ice cream sundaes, and baseball. But most of On the Road's enthusiastic readers would be startled to learn that French Canadians, both in Quebec and the United States, have for a long time claimed Kerouac as their own. To them, everything about Jack's books, from The Town and the City to Satorian Paris, is French, including his English. To the end, observed the Franco-American scholar Armand Chatier, Kerouac remained faithful to the culture of the past, his own past, that of his family, and that of his Canadian ancestors. In his memoir, American Ghosts, the Franco-American novelist David Plante, although not one of Kerouac's greatest fans, stated unequivocally that Kerouac's novels, including On the Road, in which he identifies himself as entirely American, are deeply Franco-American. Victor Lévy-Beaulieu, a Quebecois novelist and poet and a passionate admirer of Kerouac's, found his own childhood in the pages of Dr. Sachs, which he called the best documentation we possess on Franco-American life in the 1920s and 1930s. Impelled to write his book-length essay shortly after Jack's death in 1967, Beaulieu was overwhelmed by the emotional power of his feeling of connection to Kerouac. It was enough for him, for old Jack, to have just a few facts which would mark him profoundly, so that all the rest of his life turned around them, those great black flies of anguish, confusion, and despair. And Lowell, the nesting place, with its crowds of beings who had started off on the wrong foot, unhealthy people speaking a bizarre tongue, shattered, expressing only the opposite of speech, stomach noises, onomatopoeia, verbs turned into subjects, and subjects becoming objects, and expressing nothing but social misery, moral decay, death. When I read this for the first time in the 1970s, I immediately felt that Beaulieu, who had never known Jack, instinctively understood something essential about him that had eluded most of those he thought they knew Jack well, including myself. Yet when I searched my own memory, I couldn't remember one time when Jack had ever spoken about his ethnicity, as if it were an issue that in any way caused him problems or set him apart. In fact, he talked about it very little, no more than I, the child of assimilated parents, talked about being Jewish. And when he did, his allusions tended to be casual, anecdotal, nostalgic, and often culinary. But he did make a point of telling me, several times in fact, that his baptismal name was Jean-Louis Labrie de Kerouac, and that he was the descendant of a Breton baron on his father's side, who had emigrated to Quebec in the 18th century. In the spring of 1957, while passing through London, Jack went to the library of the British Museum to look up the Kerouac coat of arms and found the motto, Aimer, Travailler, Souffrir, which he felt summed up his life perfectly. I remember how one of Jack's friends, Lucien Carr, had a way of mischievously needling Jack that often made me uncomfortable. You dumb Canuck, Lucien would say, gratuitously repeating this several times in a single conversation. I'd look over apprehensively at Jack, but I never saw him wince. His face would be absolutely impassive. Years later, however, when I first read Beaulieu, something struck me. I remembered that sometimes when Jack was feeling wounded or angry, he'd sign his letters T. Jean. In his darkest states of mind, he'd use the name Jean-Louis, as if he had retreated into a different remote persona, sternly reminding outsiders like me that we did not know him at all. Thank you.